Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Dave Barry, who reads from and discusses his hilarious new book, Money Secrets, like Why Is There a Giant Eyeball on the Dollar?, published by Crown. In the weeks to come, we have Julian Barnes, Jill Connor Brown, John Hodgman, Sister Helen Prejean, Adrian McKinty, Joanne Greenberg, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
You may wonder what all the commotion is. We have Rob Simon, who is recording our speakers for his website, authorsontourlive.com, and their podcasts, so you can download them on your iPod and listen to them again and again and again. Thank you all for coming, and welcome. You will all be happy to know that Dave Barry is back with another book whose title begins with Dave Barry. This time it is Dave Barry's Money Secrets. The newest volume will be added to a veritable library of advice from a Pulitzer Prize winning author whose output of writing is staggering. From the aforementioned advice books to mystery novels and a book of fiction for children of all ages, and of course his syndicated column written while with the Miami Herald, he has entertained generations, actually, with his unique view of the world. As you all know, he retired from his stint as a columnist, so Dave has had plenty of time to reflect upon many things, not the least of which is economics. And as a result, he has put his findings into a book that anyone can refer to in order to learn the secrets of really rich people like Donald Trump, how to use your credit card to your best advantage, how to make money in the stock market, and many more pieces of monetary advice that will surely put him on the couch with Oprah. Being the magnanimous person he is, there is a certain homage paid to Oprah's former financial guru, Susie Orman, in the book, but I'll let you discover that yourself. And I'd like to mention also there will be no scandal with this book to fluster Miss Winfrey, because as Dave frequently states, he is not making this up. Please join me in welcoming our favorite columnist, Dave Barry.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you. Thanks, Margaret. Thanks to the Tattered Cover, one of the great bookstores. Well, first of all, let me explain this, okay? We're doing a reality show called Kill the Author. Which is what the purpose of, I've said this many times, but it's really coming true this way. My theory about book tours is when they schedule you, their thinking is, his book will be worth a lot more when he's dead. So they send you out on this. Anyway, so. But let me see. Where do I start? Okay, first of all, I just want to explain. Well, I didn't want to call it Dave Barry's Money. I wanted to start it with the words Harry Potter. But apparently there was some legal problem, you know. And about the Oprah thing, I watched a little. I got just caught a little. They screwed up, and I actually had about 20 minutes at the hotel. And I turned on the news, and there was Oprah getting really mad at this guy for making things up, man. And I hope to God she never finds out about me. Because I didn't know that you were not allowed to do that. So anyway, but I've been out on this brutal book tour, just going around, you know. Today it was a kind of reached this ridiculous moment. I was supposed to speak at a luncheon and basically came down to just running in and going, buy my book! Thank you, I have to go, I can't, you know. So anyway, which is really what all the book tour boils down to anyway. You know, strip away all the crap, you know, that's really what it is. You're just out whoring for your book is what you're doing. But in a good way, in a positive. I'm always wearing a condom, just, you know, just in here. There aren't any kids here tonight, are there? Yes, I'm a frog guy. Okay, well, anyway, I did have a couple of really, I'll just tell you a couple of book tour anecdotes, just like exciting celebrity moments. Because people say, well, you know, it's kind of neat, you're going on all these shows and everything, you must meet some famous people. And it's true, you do, from time to time. And I had a couple of celebrity moments on this book tour. I was on the Today Show last week, and I was out on the set waiting to be interviewed by Katie Couric. She was off doing whatever she was doing, but so I was sitting in the chair waiting for my moment, you know, and Ann Curry, who was also on the Today Show, walked by and looked at me and goes, your hair looks kind of poofy. And then Ann Curry licked her hand and smeared my hair down. So I had my hair styled by Ann Curry's spit. How does it look? You don't think you wash your hair after Ann Curry. The other big, the really big celebrity moment came after that. I had to go from there, from New York to Washington that day. And I was on the train. And in the same train car with me was Ted Koppel. And he got up at about halfway through the trip and walked to the back of the train, and he passed my seat, and he recognized me. Ted and I have been on two events together and kind of know each other, and so he stopped and we chatted a little bit, and that was nice. And then he went past back to the bathroom on the train. Then he came out, and as he was coming back, he stops at my seat again, and he says in his Ted Koppel voice, he goes, Dave, I have a question I think you would know the answer to. And I'm thinking, whoa, you know, Ted Koppel is going to ask me a question. You know, it's pretty cool. And his question was, and I am not making this up, his exact words were, does the poop still go straight down onto the railroad track? I swear to you, that is what Ted Koppel asked me in a fairly crowded railroad car. And he did not say why he wanted to know. But what I'm thinking is, if you happen to be looking on eBay and you see somebody selling a Ted Koppel souvenir from the Baltimore area, I have reason to believe that's real. So anyway, I'm out there, I'm promoting a book about money, and people always say, why did you write a book about money? There are thousands, literally thousands of books about money out there, and how to manage your money and how to get rich, and you know, and there are thousands of books, and it's true. But and I looked at those books, and they all have one major flaw. None of the royalties go to me. So I felt it was necessary to straighten that out. And as Margaret said, I have lots of useful information. How to use a credit card, you mentioned. A lot of people, like, they go by a store and they see something really cool looking in the window, and because they have a credit card, they want to buy it right then and there, which is really stupid. Wait till the store closes and come back and use your credit card to open the door. No, I'm just kidding, okay? We recommend a debit card for that. Really, though, what I'm preaching in this book is financial responsibility, long-term thinking. The problem with Americans, well, besides that they're fat and stupid, but the problem with Americans is they can't forego immediate gratification financially. They just think they have to have everything right now. They never think long-term. It's important to think long-term when you're thinking financially. Give up the present for the future. Now, I'm going to give you a simple example. Let's say that every day on your way to work, you stop at Starbucks and you buy a cup of coffee for $19? Now, say it's $4. Let's say you get the Giganto Supremo Largo, which is the small at Starbucks, and you pay $4. Okay, $4, and you don't think anything of it. $4, you know, it's $4, but it's not going to affect your financial future. You think But think about this. If you don't buy that cup of coffee, if you save that $4, not just that day, but the next every day for the next 2 weeks, at the end of that 2 weeks, you have enough money for half a keg of beer. That's the kind of long-term thinking I'm advocating in this book. Thank you. I also advocate being tough with your kids. It's not just enough for you to be financially disciplined, so must your kids. And kids today are so spoiled. They think they have to have every little thing. Everything their friends have to have it. Everything they see advertised on television, they have to have it. No! That's not right. You sit them down and you say, listen, just because your friends have food, clothing, shelter, medical care, that doesn't mean you're going to have those things. Another area where kids are very expensive, college education. You're hearing groans out there. And you should. It's unbelievable. A good college can run you $40,000 a year for a good college. And that's why it's so important to start planning now, no matter how young your child is, to make sure your child goes to a bad college. Because they're way cheaper. All right? That's why we call them bad colleges. But the key there is bad grades. Bad colleges require bad grades. And they don't just happen by themselves, parents. Be tough with your kids. Sit them down. Say, listen, you will not do your homework till you're finished with your video games, young man. Another area where I have useful advice, taxes, federal taxes particularly, take a big bite out of most people's income. Doesn't have to be that way if you know how to handle the tax system. A couple of little things. A lot of people, little tax advantages people do not take advantage of. Very simple one. I'll give you one simple one. When you're doing your taxes this year, part of the federal tax form where it says name, put your name and then the word deceased. It's a whole different tax world with that little word on it. Not just this year, but for many, many years to come. Stock market, another area where I have lots of good advice. I'll just summarize it very quickly. People give you lots of systems for how to save money in the stock market, how to make money in the stock market. Most of these systems are useless, but mine is not. I have a very simple three-stage system for making money in the stock market. If you follow these three steps, you will make money in the stock market. So listen carefully here. Step one, research the market for the past 20 years and determine which stocks have outperformed the market. Step two, get a time machine. Step three, go back and purchase those stocks. And you do those three things, you will make money. Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, we have some young folks here, so I'm going to give you a little piece of advice, a little section of the book. There's a section of the book devoted to how to get a job, which is what we would like you to do, young people, to do, and move out and stop living with us. The key to getting a job is a job interview. That's the most critical single element in a job seeking process. And in the interview, the interviewers are going to try to trap you. They're going to ask you certain what we call trap questions designed to elicit negative information to throw you off. All right? It's very important if you want the job, you learn to recognize the trap questions and know how to answer it, what's a good answer, and how to avoid a bad answer. I'm going to give you some examples of classic trap questions. Classic trap question. Why did you leave your last job? Good answer. I felt I had accomplished all I could, and I was looking for a more challenging environment where I could make an effective contribution. Bad answer. The arson investigation was getting too close. Trap question. How do you respond to criticism from your superiors? How do you respond to criticism from your superiors? Good answer. I view it as a chance to improve myself by learning from those with more wisdom and experience. Bad answer. If they're so superior, how come they can't figure out who killed their dog? Another classic trap question. What would you say is your biggest weakness? What would you say is your biggest weakness? Good answer. Sometimes I get so involved in my job that I neglect my personal life. Bad answer, heroin. There's some kids out there right now going, oh man, I screwed that up, man. I think I'll read you one more thing. This is very much on my mind of late because I'm on a book tour, so pretty much every morning I get on a plane and fly somewhere, or I get on a plane anyway. I have a the book tends to veer off into many directions, but one of those, at one point I get into a long discussion of traveling. It starts out on with how to save money on traveling, but then it just gets into traveling in general. But I do have a section in there describing traveling in the current security airport security system. I'd like to read it to you just because I'm going through it at the moment, and because if you have to take a plane, you'll have to go through it as well. So this is a little bit about airport security. Before the age of terrorism, airline security was pretty relaxed. You got to arrive at the airport 5 minutes before your plane was supposed to take off and sprint straight for your gate. If the plane had already left the gate, you could run out onto the runway waving your arms. If a security person blocked your path, you could shove them aside and shout, "Get out of my way, you fool! I have a plane to catch." You could carry a flamethrower onto the plane, as long as you were not using it to actively throw flame. If the pilot was in a good mood or hungover, he'd sometimes let passengers come into the cockpit and fly the plane for him. Alas, those carefree days are gone. Today, if you want to travel by air, you must go through a series of rigorous tests designed to guard against the danger, which is always lurking, whether we want to think about it or not, that you might actually make your flight. Here are the security basics you need to know. 1, you should arrive at the airport well in advance of your scheduled flight departure time. The Transportation Safety Administration recommends that for an 8 a.m. flight, you should get to the airport, quote, while it is still under construction. Two, once you arrive at the airport, you need to get into a line. It doesn't matter which line, just get into one. This is the heart of the airport security system. The idea is that when the terrorists get to the airport, they'll see these huge lines everywhere, and they'll say the hell with it, and go into some other line of work, such as customer service. If, when you arrive at the airport, you don't see any lines, you should get together with other travelers and organize one. Eventually, after you've spent enough time in lines, you'll reach the security checkpoint. This is the part that confuses many people. So let's break it down into a series of simple steps. Have your photo ID and boarding pass ready. You'll have plenty of time to get these out because the person in front of you, despite passing 8 signs that say in large letters, "Have your photo ID and boarding pass ready," will not have his photo ID and boarding pass ready. This person will also be towing a carry-on suitcase the size of a U-Haul trailer. Every day I get on a plane. Every day there are people in front of me on a plane trying to put things into the overhead rack that will never in a billion years, they're just pop, dunk. And I've concluded that Americans believe that if a thing has wheels on it, it's a carry-on suitcase and could go into. That's not true. Not everything that has a Buick has wheels on it. When it's your turn, show your photo ID and boarding pass to the security person, who will frown at them and in the practiced manner without actually looking at it. Put your photo ID away, but keep your boarding pass out. With your spare hand, carry your belongings to the X-ray machine. Note, the X-ray machine is perfectly safe for photographic film. It will make you sterile, but your film will be fine. Still holding your boarding pass, use your other hand to get a plastic bin. Place your laptop computer, cell phone, flamethrower, dentures, hearing aid, prosthetic limb, and children under 2 into this bin. Also remove your jacket, belt, shoes, and if the terrorism alert level is code magenta or higher, your underwire brassier. Using one hand to hold your boarding pass and the other to hold up your pants, and a third hand to shield your bosoms, shuffle through the metal detector in the meek and submissive manner employed by Dorothy, the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion when approaching the Wizard of Oz. Note, the metal detector is perfectly safe for humans. The fact that it causes the kidneys of laboratory rats to explode like party balloons is probably just a coincidence. That's all there is to it. You're now free to get dressed using the convenient, filthy airport floor provided for that purpose. Then proceed to your gate for your flight, which, by the way, has been canceled. So that's the essence of the airport security. Now you. Well, I've given you sort of a broad, you know, look at the book, really, so you get an idea how really useful it is. But I'd be glad to, if anybody has any further questions, it could be on finance or anything else, or if you have problems at home you would like to share with the group. That's why we're here tonight. That's why we get, yes. Please, would you stand up? Easy with that thing, big fella. Yeah. Your what tests? So they have to read my column and understand it? To an ask question? Like, huh? Like question would be like, he got paid to write this? Well, I find that a little terrifying, to be quite honest. I mean, we've done some stupid things in Florida. Well, we would never use my work. You know, like they have those things, no, you can't sell drugs within 500 yards of a school. You know, it's especially bad. It's bad. It's like more bad. You know, it's illegal, but it's even more illegal here. We do that with my columns in the school system in Florida. You know, you can't even, there's like a picture of me and an arrow going through it. So are your kids, do they seem any dumber to you? Like, because that would be a likely explanation, I would think. Wow. Better your state than mine. I guess that's all you're going to think. No, I'm deeply honored, really. I'm just thinking, I wonder if they're paying me for that. You know? Yes. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I am serious. Oh, look. Starts crying. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I know, he's taken to sending me pictures of himself wearing just a thong and Vaseline. Yeah. He said, hey, you want to come out here and we can herd sheep together? You know, he's like, yeah. So I think it's some kind of code. I don't get it. No. No, I'm sorry. I really am. You know, I did. I stopped writing on my column because basically I wrote. You know, let me explain. I wrote that column for 30 years, basically the same column over and over again. It was a long time to write, you know, when you have absolutely nothing to say. I just kind of reached the point where I thought, you know, I've really said everything. I've done every possible kind of 800-word humor essay I can think of. I've done it. So I just thought, while I still kind of like it and while people still kind of are happy with the way I do it, better stop now than, you know, later on when they're, you know, begging me to not write anymore column. So that's, but you know what I discovered? This is true. I wrote that column. I stopped writing it a year ago. And even when I did write it, I only wrote it once a week. To this day, literally every day, someone comes up to me and says, I really love your column. I read it every day. So what I've learned is you don't have to actually write a column to be a beloved columnist. You can just, in their mind, be... It's kind of like Paris Hilton, you know? I asked somebody just the other day, somebody who really knows everything, what exactly does she do? And nobody knows. Nobody has a clue, but she's unbelievably... I think maybe she writes a column. I don't know. Yes. Oh, that's... Why are you... Have you participated in the Tropic Hunt? No. Well, we do a thing at the... We did it this year. We did it in, I think, November. It's an elaborate, complicated puzzle that we erect in the somewhere in the South Florida area, and thousands of people come out and try to solve it. And it's a lot of fun. It's kind of weird, but fun. And yeah, I think we'll probably do it. I mean, we've done it every year for like the last 10 years or so, so we'll probably keep doing it. Yeah. Synchronized swim. Yeah. Oh, man, what a moment. That was my Olympic moment. I've had some really good Olympic moments. I'll tell you two of them. One of them was that one, the synchronized swimming. It was in Atlanta in 96, and I had written a column kind of making fun of synchronized swimming, which looks, let's be honest, like the world's stupidest sport. And I got a call from the public relations person for the U.S. synchronized swimming team saying, "Oh, yeah, Mr. Humor Boy, you think it's easy? Come on out and work out with the U.S. synchronized swimming team." So I did. I went to, I think it was at Emory University, and first of all, the pool was the size of Lake Erie. It was the biggest, and it had no shallow end. So, like, you have to tread water for a long time. But anyway, you get in the water. I'm in the water with all these very fit young women, and they're showing me the first basic move, which is you do this. And the idea is, you know, like your hands up and you're smiling, and but underneath you're doing something with your feet, which they showed me how to do, right? So, you know, like, so we're all lined up there, and I'm already tired now because we've been treading water for like 45 seconds, which is nearing my limit. And they go, "Let's do it." And I have a photo of what happened next. But anyway, yes. We all go like this, and then all of them are still up there going like this, and there's like, bubbles. And I'm down on like the very bottom of the Emory, which I think was their goal, just to get me down, maybe leave me down there, you know. So that was, it was pretty amusing. The funniest single picture of me I've ever seen was with the synchronized swimming team. But the other, my other big Olympic participation moment was in Nagano in 98, I guess, Winter Olympics. And I wanted to do a column about curling. And I, which is like, come on, curling, come on. Any sport where people are using brooms, you know? Bjelica Kidditch, okay, yeah. But it's kind of like hard to picture how that ever got, who would have thought that up in the first place, you know? Could have been worse, could have been like they could be out there with toasters if it had been just a different level of alcohol consumption, whatever night. Whatever night they came up with curling, I don't know. But anyway, they had a broom, and that was that. So anyway, I go out to the official Olympic training center for the, and it's like, it's this giant facility, and all the way down the ice is like, you know, the Swedish team and the Japanese. They're all practicing their curling, and here's the U.S. team kind of in the middle of this giant facility. And they give the head of the captain of the U.S. women's team gave me this lesson on how to curl. You take this heavy thing called a stone, and it has a handle on it, and you slide it down the ice. It's kind of like shuffleboard. And the big thing was, she was stressing over and over the importance of, like, bend your knee and slide your, you know. So I really was working, bending the knee and sliding the thing, you know. And I really have it all worked out. So comes the big moment where I'm going to actually let the stone go, and I'm thinking, okay, Ben, don't forget to bend your knee inside as I'm bending the stone, you know, and I do it. And next thing I know, the light's everywhere, people are scouting, and they're here yelling, "Let go of the stone! Let go!" And I was going, so the picture of me curling, I'm on my back going like, and there's like Swedish people going, you know. So. And that was the last time they allowed the press onto the ice at the Olympic Training Center. Yes. Well, no, we just established that's bad for them. Thank you. But you weren't required to read it in school. Oh, no. TV show based on my life. Baywatch. Oh, Dave's World. Is it coming out on DVD? I don't know. I don't think so. It ran like, I think the magic number of years that a TV show has to run is 5 years, and I think Dave's World ran for 4. So people tell me that sometimes they see it on the somewhere, you know, like probably Peruvian satellite or something. But I don't think it's still out there. That was interesting. I really had very little to do with that show. they bought the rights to the couple of books I wrote, and I never really expected it would be a show, or you know, and, but it actually did get turned into a show, and it was kind of a nice show. It didn't have anything to do with me exactly. It was written by people in Los Angeles who really didn't know that much about being a newspaper humor comic, which was clearly evident by the plots, which never involved writing. Although every now and then Harry Anderson would be walking around with a brown manila envelope, which was the column, which I got a lot of crap from my friends because that's really not how it works, you know. If you ever did print it out, you wouldn't put it in a brown manila envelope. And, you know, it's silly. But, yeah. Of all the books and columns I've written, do I have a personal favorite? Not really. No, I mean, there's been a lot of columns that got a huge reaction from people and, you know, that have affected people, some say, or have had effect on me. One of my favorite, I actually got in trouble for this one. Has anybody ever heard of North Dakota? Right, but you're not there. You're not there now, are you? Right. But anyway, I got in a situation with North Dakota. What happened? North Dakota is losing population. For example, these people left, and but the population declining. Either people leave or the wolves eat them. One of the two. But they want people to move there. They'd love to have more people move there. If you go there, they'll pull you over and say, "Do you want to be in the legislature? Would you like to be lieutenant governor?" You know, because he just left. He's gone. You know, so anyway, they came up with an idea. Now, confirm for me, I'm not making this up, that they did. There was talk of changing the name of the state of North Dakota. There was serious talk of, because people, they thought that was a bad image, because people thought it was cold and tundra, you know.
Which it is.
But they, that they thought they could improve the image by changing the name from North Dakota to Dakota. Dakota. Sounds good, huh? Dakota. Tahiti, Hawaii, Dakota. One. Anyway, I thought it was a pretty stupid, you know, way to. So I wrote a column making fun of that, and I got in huge trouble. Don't mess with North Dakota. First of all, I got an angry letter from everybody in the state, which is nearly 115 letters. And second of all, this was the fiendish part of the North Dakota revenge scheme. They invited me up there in January and dedicated a sewage lifting station in my honor. This is absolutely true. This is, if you go to Grand Forks, North Dakota, for any reason, such as your plane has crashed there, there is a brick building, and on it, in foot-high letters, it says, "Dave Barry, lift station number 16. And inside is the equipment that lifts the sewage, which is a concept I don't get, all right? I would just leave it down there, you know what I mean? But in North Dakota, they lift their sewage. They also are into ice fishing. But anyway, they had this big ceremony, and they had a brown piece of paper over the sign for the big dedication, and they had the media came, and the mayor of Grand Forks, it was really cold. It was like 20 below zero in June. No, it was really, really cold. And so we're out there shivering, and they have this brown piece of paper over, and the mayor of Grand Forks reads this proclamation very eloquently comparing my work to the production of human excrement. And then comes the big moment. They have me tear the paper off, I'm standing there, I'm looking up, and on the side of the building, I see my name, and I smell the sewage in the air, and I hear whoop, 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 which is the sound of people applauding in mittens. So it was pretty glamorous, pretty glamorous. Yeah. Thank you. Oh, that's right. Is it? Well, first of all, can I just point my field coordinator is here tonight, Ted Hoptegaber, in the back. Ted, would you wave to them? Ted is the man who, he's also the road manager for the Rock Bottom Remainders, and I just, thank you, yeah. And I want to, before I give you my platform for president, I should say that the Remainders are going to be playing in Denver on April 27th. Yep. Right? And where did you say, the Paramount? And there will be alcohol. We say it because we're a, I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's a rock band of authors. And I believe coming to Denver will be Amy Tan, Scott Turow, Mitch Albom, Ridley Pearson, Roy Blunt Jr., me. Who else is coming? Anybody? Greg Isles? Roger McGuinn of the Byrds will be joining us. Stephen King will not be with us, I should say that. He is... What? We are the band. It's because it's not... Nobody wants us to warm up for him because it's not that warm when we're done. You know what I mean? It's distinctly cooler, really, in a musical sense. But we do have Roger McGuinn come out, and he's an actual musician, and then we all turn our guitars down to like -4, and because Roger's unbelievable. But it's a great night, and it's for a really good cause. So anyway, we raise money for those folks, and but anyway, it's a fun night, even though we're not a really very good band. We play our genre. Roy Blunt Jr., who is our MC, we're the only band I know of that travels with an MC. Describes our genre as hard listening music. But I say, well, the technique we use musically, the musical technique is called the rumor method, which is to say everybody's playing something and then a rumor goes around that there's been a chord change. And we all try to find out what that new chord is. Anyway, back to my, I'm sorry, I'm not one of those politicians who doesn't actually answer the question. My main platform that I've sort of founded my campaign on, and it's still the issue that I think is the sort of the foundation of my campaign, I favor the death penalty for whoever it is that made Americans use low-flow toilets. You young people don't know this, but there was a time when we had great toilets in this country. Our toilets were the envy that we could suck down a mature sheep with the toilets we had in this country. And then somebody decided we would save water by buying little toilets that don't flush anything. So you have to flush them 86 times to saving water. We're saving a lot of water here. So anyway, that's sort of the heartbeat of my... I have a health care plan as well. I advocate that we need a law that says that if you have to wait for more than 30 minutes to see the doctor, you get to give the doctor a shot. Thank you. The other medical thing I would do, I'd make it my highest priority to devote billions of research dollars to helping the medical profession find a way to get to the prostate gland other than the way it's getting to it now. I mean, my idea is like, well, you know, some kind of operation where the doctor would stand about 75 yards away and go, "Looks good from here, Dave." Yeah. I'm not really disdainful of canines. I just don't think that the dogs are the brightest organisms on the face of the earth. But I've had wonderful... I'm going to give you my one example of that, and I'm going to stop with that because we're actually running over my time. I can Margaret over there, and he's going to be here all night. I used to have two dogs. I had a large main dog named Ernest and a small auxiliary backup dog named Zippy. And this is a absolutely true story. This dates back to Hurricane Andrew, which passed directly over what was my house. Hurricane Andrew. Before Hurricane Andrew, I used to let Ernest and Zippy out every morning via a two-stage procedure. Okay, and you know, if you have a dog, you know, going out in the morning is a very big deal to the dog. Okay, two-stage. Open the back door, and then we had a screen enclosure, which you need in South Florida to keep the mosquitoes from stealing your patio furniture. Right. So I would open the back door, and Ernest and Zippy would run across the patio to the screen door, and I'd open the screen door, and they would be out in the yard. Okay, so that was the procedure: back door, screen door, yard. And Ernest and Zippy learned the procedure the way dogs learn a procedure. So anyway, comes Hurricane Andrew. The screen enclosure is orbiting the Earth, okay? But the screen door was still there. So you know where I'm going with this. Even those of you who think dogs are smart know exactly where I'm going with this. Just a door in a frame surrounded by nothing but yard, okay? So I'd open the back door, and Nurse Zibby would run to the screen door, because that's the procedure. So that's why I don't think dogs are the smartest animals on the face of it. Anyway, please, thanks you all for coming. I'd be happy to sign your books, or just say hi. You don't have to buy a book if you want to just say hi. I'd be glad to do that. Please don't forget Denver Scores. That'll be a fun night. The Remainers will be there. Thanks to the Tattered Cover for having me. This is one of the great bookstores. Thank you. Yeah.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Julian Barnes, Jill Connor Brown, John Hodgman, Sister Helen Prejean, Adrian McKinty, Joanne Greenberg, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on January 26th, 2006.